The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Global Reach, the show that helps your business have strategies, manage risks, and find opportunities in the global marketplace. This week, our show is about globalization and its impact on increasing income divides, powerless politicians, poor policy outcomes, unintended consequences, and why all this is creating greater risk for all of us. My guests are Roy Stevenson, calling in from the UK, and Sonny McKinney, calling in from the Netherlands. They are both payment gurus and experienced in working with companies all over the world. So we've been doing shows on globalization, on governance, on leadership, on the arrogance of institutions, also on income equality, the future of capitalism, the future of democracy, and again, how this is impacting all of us in the international business space. Well, this show is going to bring all of those themes together. Welcome, Roy. Welcome, Sonny.
Good to be here.
And definitely good to be here. Thank you.
And thank you for giving up your evenings to be on the show. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest before we go into this. It's going to be a very, very lively discussion, and I suspect it's going to be just a little contentious. Roy Stevenson advises banking, payment cards, airlines, retail clients from all around the world. He helps them with develop best practices in customer marketing, loyalty, and relationship management. He's a 25-year veteran of the industry, and he has worked with consumer-facing companies in dozens of countries. And he can't help note the parallel trends of increasing globalization and stagnation and what they've been doing to the markets. Roy, as a consultant, he's got extensive experience with banking and payment card clients. He's an acknowledged world expert in rewards program, and he's been a key player in loyalty initiatives on every continent. He's worked, for example, with startups for Air Miles coalitions in the Netherlands and Spain, put together audits of reward program in the UK, Canada, Brazil, Spain, Singapore, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. And he's also done work in the commercial card space and authored a book called Marketing Planning for Financial Services. So truly a global view. Sonny McKinney also brings us a tremendous global view. He's a senior analyst with Global Connect, which offers portfolio of payment in over 170 countries and for 170 currencies. He's a 24-year veteran with extensive experience in both management and day-to-day logistics of financial services and in payment industries. He's held executive positions in technology, finance, pricing, costing, transfer pricing options, business development, and product management. He's worked as an architect in bringing Europe's premier processing application to the U.S. And again, he comes to us with a truly global view. So, Roy, Sonny, you both come out of the business, the banking, the payments world. Roy, you're an advisor to banks, airlines, utility, yet our conversation that started looking at what was going on in reward programs and customer loyalty turned into one about disastrous impact of growing income disparities between the top 1 to 5% of incomes in the U.S., Europe, and the mature economies, and then the rest of us. You've been said it's globalization, it's powerless politician, and bad policy outcomes. How do we get to that from rewards?
Well, hi, Tay. It's nice to be talking to you again.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. As business people, in whatever industry we happen to be operating, naturally enough, we have to take into account the macroeconomic trends which are happening, not only in our own markets and countries, but also around the world. And as I sort of scan the news that comes in from the business magazines and the payment industry specialist publications, a number of figures jumped out and really hit me in the eye over this past couple of months. And if you don't mind, could I just mention three of them maybe?
Please.
One of them, and this was quoted as recently as September in The Economist, a study of income distribution in the U.S. found the richest 1% of the American population took 19% of national income last year. That was the biggest share since 1928. Looking at the UK, Stephen King, who's chief economist of HSBC Bank, said that in the first 4 decades of his life, real British incomes per head almost tripled. In his fifth decade, they rose just 4%. And then looking at Russia, for example, astonishing figure, 35% of household wealth in Russia is owned by, guess how many, 110 people. I mean, that's extraordinary, isn't it? And it's those income disparities which I think affect all of our businesses, in no matter what market we happen to be operating, no matter what industry we happen to do our business.
So why should our listeners be concerned? I mean, we've seen the statistics, and I understand if you're involved politically, and anybody who's been a listener here knows I am, and we've touched on this, I think, the first time you came. You know, as business, can't we just market to that 1%?
We can, but I think somebody said something that was very interesting recently, that what's happened is that globalization and the productivity gains from technology have hollowed out the what used to be the skilled blue-collar working class. And so what you have left is a polarization, if you will. At the top, you have a very, very rich, very narrow strand of people who are in both developed and developing economies. And you find, I was reading a study recently of where should retail go in this kind of environment, and it was suggesting certainly focus on the top 1%, the new millionaires, if you like. But what happens to the mass market? There's only so many expensive handbags that you can sell. If you look at the market for example, family cars or for regular kinds of fast-moving consumer goods, things of that sort, the demand for those products is going sharply down. And not just that, the figures support the fact that, for example, in retail trade in the UK, the figures are declining steadily. And one of the reasons for it simply is people don't have the money to spend, and those that do have a little bit of money are frightened to spend it because they're anxious about the way the economy is going. So yes, it does affect us all, I think.
So there are not enough millionaires to go around for all the people who'd like to sell to them.
Not enough millionaires to go around. Absolutely not. Most of the, I guess most of the audience listening to this program will not be dealing in products that are aimed at that market.
So can we have, we'll start with the consumer space, but a retail space that is just focused on Tiffany's, Walmart, and thrift stores? And what happens to everybody else in the middle market?
Well, I think what people have to do is focus on, for example, in the UK, we find that there is a growing concentration of wealth in the hands of aging baby boomers. A recent survey identified that, in this country at least, they control 80% of UK's net personal wealth. Well, it's a significant piece of market to go for. There's another piece of work that suggests that singletons, relatively affluent, largely urban, once again, are an attractive market to go for. That's in developed economies. Elsewhere, I think the motto is simple, go east, go south. If you can afford to cross borders, that's where the new markets, the emerging markets, are beginning to show real promise.
So what's been the cumulative impact of this wealth shift on policy, because all of us who are operating internationally operate in a government policy context. And one of the things you were saying is we're getting really bad policy that can be really damaging to business out of this whole thing. And I would think that businesses really have increasing influence on government.
I think politicians have far less power than they claim, and there's a variety of reasons for that. And one of the main ones, of course, is globalization. Increasingly, we find that what's happening are trends that cross borders. Governments, by definition, don't cross borders. Look at the wrangling, for example, that happens in the EU whenever national interests come into conflict with European interests, if you will. So one argument will be that causes are global and governments are all too national. Secondly, I think that politicians take actions that predictably lead to wrong outcomes. For example, in bids to attract companies to invest in particular markets, governments offer scams, boondoggles, call them favorable corporate tax rates. And what then happens is when companies quite legitimately take advantage of these tax deals, a quoted euro bond exemption, for example, the double Irish, what then happens is they pay very little tax indeed because of the way they've organized their tax affairs, and politicians then have the gall to lambast them publicly for taking advantage of laws which they, the politicians themselves, have made.
I think it's Washington State is giving Boeing something like $9 billion not to leave. Sonny, what's your take on this? We've got about 3 minutes to break.
Sure. I agree with most of what Roy was saying is, you know, the top 1% equal the 19% of income. But, you know, the other thing that we also need to keep in mind that, you know, of that 19%, you know, they contribute, you know, 70-80% of tax revenue to the government. So we're looking at it as that perspective as well. But I would also argue that consumerism and the purchasing of goods and so forth is not necessarily concentrated in the higher income brackets. Yes, the average transaction, the average value of a particular purchase might be higher in that level, but then you're also looking at the middle income, lower income, which are essentially still driving. They're still driving all the economies, and you're 100% right. Globalization. And the companies are taking advantage of bad tax policy. I mean, an example would be the U.S. Essentially double taxation. They're constantly wanting to try to tax a company's worldwide earnings, where no other country does that. So they're shooting themselves in the foot. So I agree with what Roy is saying in that respect. And you need to go global, because individual mature markets like the U.S., like Europe, they're starting to dry up with regard to growth. And it's now east and it's now south. Absolutely.
I think some of the argument is when a company takes its earnings from countries where it might be taxed and, say, goes to Ireland where it doesn't actually do any business, and puts all of its income there, you start to have a problem. We've got to go to break in about a minute.
The companies that are actually stateless, I believe I'm right in saying, moment of correction, I think Apple has companies that have no legal residence in any country in the world.
On that note, we're going to go to break. When we come back, we're going to look at some examples of policy outcomes that have had incredible unintended consequences that affect all of us. So don't go away.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. The way we do banking today continues to evolve. No longer is it just brick-and-mortar locations or traditional banker's hours. Today, banking is 24/7. It's in the home. It's on the go. It's digital. Tune in to Breaking Banks with Brett King for a look at how traditional banking as we know it has changed due to a loss of trust, changing economic conditions and consumer behavior, government involvement, and, of course, technology. What does it all mean? Listen every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific, on the Voice America Business Channel. From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Hi, welcome back to the second segment of Global Reach. I'm here with my guest, Roy Stevenson, calling in from the U.K., and Sunny McKinney calling in from the Netherlands. Again, thank you both of you for being on the show.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
When we went to break, we were talking about globalization and the power shift and how politicians have a real tendency to propose simple-minded solutions for quick electoral benefits. I think you were saying that, Roy. What are some examples of that kind of law that have been passed?
The one I had in mind in particular was one from the UK, where we find ourselves facing very steeply rising energy costs. So the Labour government in opposition right now suggests that what they will do is they'll freeze prices. Now, that takes no account of what happens before the price freeze comes into effect or what happens after the price freeze comes into effect. It's stupid.
So you're saying they will misdiagnose the problem and prescribe the wrong remedies?
And we'll find that as we go on to talk later on about interchange, for example, where politicians around the world have consistently got it wrong.
So first, for our audience who doesn't know what interchange is, what exactly is interchange? And why should they care about it?
Maybe that's one for Sunny.
Okay, Tay, I'd be happy to. Interchange, for all intents and purposes, was designed to essentially offset the risk that a card issuer has in the acceptance of payments for a merchant. That was the primary definition and the reason for interchange.
So it's a fee for the credit card transaction?
That's exactly what it is.
Okay.
It comes exactly.
Okay, so what's the issue with interchange rates, and why do I care about it?
Well, the issue comes down to the fact is that it is a part of each individual credit card transaction. You can't get away from it. It is essentially transfer of revenues, if you will, or from a merchant, for those in your audience as well, to the cardholder, to the card-issuing institution. And again, it was supposed to offset the card-issuing institution's risk for acceptance of those particular transactions. And interchange is really defined based on how a merchant decides to accept transactions, the types of customers they go after, the type of products and services they offer, and so forth.
So what kind of numbers are we talking about? I understand they're kind of, in the U.S., we put about $1 to $2 trillion worth of transactions to pay for them with our debit cards. What does that turn into in terms of the fees in this market?
Well, this is where it became somewhat interesting. And the fact is that, again, a debit card is a kind of a card product that would invariably have a lower risk. At least that was the argument by several merchants and so forth. So we've been involved in quite a bit of litigation surrounding interchange brought by the Retail Federation and merchants individually and so forth. But it comes down quick.
Sunny, I think we lost that. Something drowned out your voice.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just saying that we have billions of dollars at stake with regard to interchange. It is a huge pie, and merchants are clamoring for the fact is saying that the issuing institutions are effectively using this scheme, if you will, or this offset to risk as not necessarily an offset to risk anymore, but more of a revenue stream for themselves. And that's essentially the crux of their argument. And this is where the government gets involved. When they start, as Roy correctly pointed out, that they start getting involved, they start playing to an audience, they beat up on, it's always good theater to beat up on business. It's always good theater to beat up on, everybody doesn't like the card associations. Everybody has issues. Everybody has the story to tell about something that may or may not have happened that is bad to them. So obviously, they're easy to beat up on.
And since 2008,
politicians get involved.
Since 2008, I think banks haven't been too popular.
No, they haven't. No, they have not. They're easy fodder. Let's put it that way.
Roy, you've been writing about it. What's your take?
Well, I absolutely agree with Sunny. I think there is, we perhaps have a difference of emphasis on where the balance lies between compensation for risk-taking by acquirers versus the fact that it genuinely is a revenue stream for the issuing institution. There might be a difference of emphasis there, but apart from that, I absolutely agree. The merchants have absolutely been clamoring in many, many markets to get their hands on this huge pie. In Canada, for example, the coalition cause itself stops sticking it to us. I mean, it's as vociferous as that. And inevitably, politicians like to showboat, and they like to say, okay, fine, here is a way in which we can support consumers. We can show ourselves as being the good guys by taking on these fearful banks and card issuers. The plain fact of the matter is that whenever they have done it, and in particular the first experiment in this was in Australia, when the U.S. authorities took a look at what had actually happened in Australia, they could find no evidence whatsoever that merchants had passed on any of the savings from reduced interchange to consumers. Not a shred of evidence.
I thought that was the big deal. It was going to be a great boon to consumers in terms of that the merchants would all be able to charge less.
No evidence whatsoever.
Well, I'll tell you, you hit it perfectly. I mean, that is exactly the pitch that Senator Durbin used when he was holding his hearings, and with regard to, and they specifically went after debit interchange because it was an easy one. It was easy for them to go after debit because invariably the idea of a debit transaction, meaning that we're looking at real-time movement of funds from a from a cardholder to a merchant, would be less risky. So therefore, they went after that particular type of interchange, saying that the issuers were overcharging. The issuers were using it as a revenue stream. So therefore, if we arbitrarily lowered that interchange rate based on factors that what they thought were the correct risk parameters, that the savings that merchants would, first of all, that the merchants would receive the savings, And secondly, and this is very, in my opinion, very naively thought. Now, whether they knew or they didn't know, there could be arguments about that. Personally, I think they did know. But they pitched the idea that merchants' cost of acceptance of these cards would go down. Therefore, they would pass this on, this savings on to consumers through essentially market pressures. And what we've said, as Roy pointed out in Australia, there has not been any shred of evidence that this savings has been passed on to the consumer at all.
Has anybody been squawking about it in public? Or is it just the banks railing against the merchants now? Well, what's the wealth transfer between the banking industry, the bank issuers, and the retailers? How much are we talking about?
Roy, I think the last figure I saw was essentially well over hundreds of millions and close to $1 billion in movement. The fact is that these financial institutions have to plug a hole of that amount of money. So what does that mean? Obviously, they have their own boards of directors, their own investors they have to deal with. So banks invariably have to scramble and find how do I make up for it? How do I make up for this shortfall of revenue? They're going after consumers.
Sonny, was it just around $1 billion? Because I know when we did the NiPay event, which is where we met on Monday, and we had David True, president of NiPay, on the show last week, I thought the figure was a $5 to $6 billion with wealth transfer from financial institutions to the retailing industry.
It very well could be. But again, coming from the financial industry, I tend to kind of keep things, at least try to be a little bit conservative.
Okay.
In terms of this, how did the public do out of reduced interchange? What you find is that merchants are not only pocketing the savings they make, they actually have the barefaced impudence to charge customers for using their card. So, for example, Qantas in Australia currently surcharges just short of 3% on a typical fare from Sydney to Singapore. Just short of 3%. Now,
wow.
These are internet bookings, which could have been made without the use of a card, but which the airlines still cheerfully charge a premium for. I mean, it's barefaced.
Wow.
The other side of the coin is, and this is actually making a huge assumption, that the merchants actually receive this benefit. What people don't really understand is this was a huge benefit, not necessarily to the merchants, but this was a huge benefit to the merchants acquiring bank. Because
explain what you mean by that.
Basically, a merchant has to have a bank in order to sponsor them into the card association's systems. So essentially, the transfer of wealth was from the issuing banks to the merchant's acquiring bank.
So
the bank that issues the card, the cardholder's bank, essentially is transferring the wealth, if you will, we'll use those terms, to the merchant's bank. And invariably what's happening is the merchant's bank is not passing that on to the merchant. They're keeping it. It is a huge windfall for them. Now,
I would have, Sonny, we've got to go to break now, and I would have thought they could often be the same bank, that a bank could issue cards and the bank could also acquire merchants, but you're going to explain it when we get back from break. And I want to talk about some of the other consequences, because issuing banks that aren't acquiring merchants have been making up that shortfall of money in other ways. But we'll talk about that when we get back from break.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks.
We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. Thanks for sticking with us. I'm here with Roy Stevenson, the founder of Strategic Planning and Marketing in the UK, and Sonny McKinney, who's a senior analyst with Global Collect, and he's calling in from the Netherlands. Thank you again for sharing your evening with us. So when we went to break, we were talking about banks that are card issuers, issuing banks, and banks that are merchant acquirers. And just define it again and tell me, aren't they the same banks? Don't banks do both?
In many cases, yes. But then you also look at the notion that you can have a card issuer that will be obviously different than the merchant's bank. So in some instances where they are the same, again, it's there essentially is no impact to the bank at a extreme corporate level. But, you know, within individual business units of the bank, obviously they're competing against each other as well because they have to show growth. There is a huge fight internally. For where? How do I book the money? Where does the money go?
And what's been happening to consumers in terms of the banks, particularly the banks or the bank divisions that feel like they're losing out on income?
Well, I know that in the U.S. income. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Roy.
It's not just interchange income that's declining so rapidly in many markets around the world, and that's a pattern that's going to repeat itself, I'm quite sure, as politicians look to gain electoral favor. That's not just the only source of income that's declining. Net interest margins, that's to say what a credit card issuer can charge on a balance that a customer carries over from one month to another, and the bank's own cost of providing those funds, those net interest margins are declining also. At the same time, politicians have taken aim at various of the fees that card issuers used to charge, for example, late payments, bounce checks, things of this sort. So all of those sources of income have been coming down dramatically, and card issuers find themselves in a difficult position right now. And what you find, of course, is the old waterbed example that you press down in one place and it pops up in another.
Oh.
And we've seen that. We've seen that in the States with the impact of essentially the government's arbitrary decision to lower the cost of debit transactions, which is essentially known in our industry as the Durbin Amendment. It essentially has caused issuing banks to look elsewhere, and part of that is to look elsewhere within internally within their organizations.
Because a lot of these issuing banks are not just card issuers. They have deposit accounts. They have cardholders and they have consumers that have accounts there. And you've got people getting accounts canceled. You've got people that their reward programs have been canceled or the benefits that they receive.
Such as your reward program on your debit card.
Absolutely. As soon as Durbin was announced, I got the letter that said, guess what? We can no longer offer you a rewards program on your debit card. So, and then you also get the notion that a lot of consumers, they rely heavily on the fact is that the banks have traditionally charged some lower fees or no fees in order to attract the lower income. So now that's going away. The banks can no longer afford to do that. So where do these lower income people go?
You mean a free checking account?
Exactly, free checking. Where do they go if they can't afford to keep the account at the bank? Or banks are canceling them, telling them to leave?
There's no question.
Something, is it something like 80% of checking accounts are not profitable? Did I hear that somewhere?
It's a very, very high proportion. And what's happening, of course, is that banks are now getting much more clever at understanding how individual customers generate or don't generate profit for them. And there's no question in my mind, but as banks become more sophisticated in unearthing this profitability data, they're going to be doing everything and at least to discourage the non-profitable customers, if not actively to drive them away. Now, what that does to the unbanked population, we have yet to see, but my guess is it's going to increase it.
So where are the, if I'm a lower income person, where do I go to find a free checking account?
You go to the internet and look at a comparison website would be my guess.
But I think also, aren't we seeing a migration into credit unions and into some of the smaller local and regional banks that are still offering them?
We have seen, I mean, at least what I've seen is that does happen, but again, that also puts considerable pressure on the credit unions and the small regional banks, because now they have to support a greater mix of their accounts are now lower margined or no margin. And so what do? They have to offset the cost because it does cost them to maintain these accounts. So they have to do something. So what do? Do they increase interest rates? Do they restrict loans? So there's a rolling down the hill effect, if you will. And it all comes back and impacts the consumer.
Sounds a little bit like you don't have health insurance in the U.S. Where do you go? You go to the emergency room. Who pays for that? And that can be the hospital or the taxpayer.
There is one other source of banking services, incidentally, at least in the UK, and I can't speak for the US, and that is increasingly we see the big retailers, I'm thinking here particularly the supermarket chains, who have big ambitions to get into the banking and financial services arena. Right now they're offering insurance, they're offering credit cards, they're offering everything bar checking accounts or current accounts, as we call them over here. Why? Because it's very, very expensive to offer. And that's what's really holding back Tesco, holding back Sainsbury's from entering at the full banking market because they find it so expensive to offer basic checking account facilities.
Interesting. Over here, we're seeing Walmart really into the banking fray. They've teamed up with American Express with Bluebird. But it's really, sounds like it's really this, I won't say little decision, but this one set of decisions is really changing the dynamics of both the retail industry and the banking industry. Roy, what's going on in the European Union? You had some choice words for interchange reform efforts in the European Union. What did you call them again?
Naive, willfully ignorant, and showboating were the three words, the three phrases I picked out.
And why?
Essentially, what we have here is politicians who are looking once again to wave the consumer flag, and they're taking very much, I believe, the lead from what's happened in the U.S.,
and they have taken the view that to cut interchange on payment card products will inevitably be to benefit consumers. This flies in the face of all the evidence we've seen in markets around the world, and it's there's any number of studies which show that in point of fact reducing interchange produces no benefit for the customer. And in fact, I saw a survey recently that suggested it actually did positive harm to the customer in the way of, for example, reduced rewards programs, the introduction of fees for services that previously were free. But nevertheless, the EU, in the face of all the evidence, decides to go ahead and cut interchange. And the result, I have no doubt, will be that customers are no worse off than before, and in a number of cases are actually worse off than before, because their rewards programs will be terminated or will be less rich than they were before, and merchants will pocket the savings and say nothing about it.
Well, this sounds somehow like a game of mirrors or blowing smoke. Is somebody blowing smoke here?
Well, that was actually the name of a piece I wrote which described what was happening in the European Union. Precisely, it is blowing smoke, and in point of fact, the arguments they bring forward that don't stack up. The other one they suggest is that by reducing interchange, they will attract new entrants into the business. Now, how that one works, I don't know. How you argue that by making a business less profitable, you make it more attractive to new entrants is something that baffles me.
Sunny, any thoughts?
I was going to ask Roy a question. And have you seen the fact is with the arbitrary reduction of interchange, whether it be in Australia or what Europe is doing now, with that it tends to go after MasterCard and so forth. But have you seen or have you read anything about the fact is that it's essentially tightening up credit from the cardholder perspective, meaning that if they no longer have interchange as a revenue stream, so if you think about it, they actually have to restrict credit to someone that would be on borderline as far as whether they would issue them a card or not, because they can no longer rely on interchange for their income.
Absolutely. And the flip side of that, Sonny, is that you see APRs, average rates of interest, increasing. I saw a card offer the other day that carried an APR of 34.9%.
Holy. Wow.
34.9% with bank rate at 0.5%.
Is somebody saying usury here? Serious?
Well, actually, Tay, this comes down into, at least in the States, and I'm sure you're well aware, that you get into the states individually, that they change their banking laws, and they change their usury laws. I mean, let's face it, we have a lot of banks, a lot of issuers, that essentially have no presence in Maryland or some other friendly state, where they essentially have no limit in what they can charge a consumer or a cardholder. And so Roy's right. I've seen cards at 22, 25, 34. And
you know, at those rates, though, how does the consumer ever pay the card issuer back? Or how does the consumer stay out of bankruptcy?
Well, it doesn't revolve is the first thing. In other words, he pays off a card each month, in which case the APR is utterly irrelevant to him. But for those who do revolve, even a small amount of their balance each month, they're paying through the nose. It's interesting to note, incidentally, that on the product I just mentioned, it carried a top credit limit of only £1,500. So clearly it was aimed at people with very, very restricted incomes, let's say.
I would also counter to what Roy said, is that for those consumers that pay off their balance every month, they will invariably find the card issuer canceling them because they're not making any money.
Yeah, I think unless their average monthly spend is high, in which case it's worth the issuer's time to keep the account on. But yes, if they pay off each month and don't generate interest income and interchange income is declining, what's the point of having them on board?
So we're back to they want to court the 1%. And on that note, we're going to go to break. When we come back, I want to tie this back into your first point about globalization and powerless politicians and widening income gap. But don't go away. We're also going to talk a little bit about the future of rewards programs.
the boardroom to you. Voice America Business Network.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
So when we went to break, you were saying that people who are really good stewards of their money, they pay off their balances every month, could face their cards getting canceled?
Absolutely. It's happened to me. I used the card, and I would constantly pay the balance off each month. So essentially, the card issuing institution earned no interest off of me, and there was no annual fee. So essentially, I was costing them money. So they canceled it.
Tie this back into the theme that somehow this is all linked to globalization, widening income gaps, and powerless politicians. And we're seeing distortion of two different industries here, and consumers being forced out of their cards, and some of them forced out of their bank accounts. Who wants to pick that up?
Well, if I could just make a start on that, and then Sonny can add his own take on it. I mean, my view is that the public as a whole recognizes the increasing disparity in incomes between the very, very rich and the very poorly off. We have food banks in the UK, for heaven's sake. That's not been happening since the 1930s. And politicians respond to that. But they respond to it in ways which, as we've seen already, are often misguided. There's a set of reasons for this as well, that very frequently the time frames in which politicians have to operate are very, very limited. Typical government in the UK lasts, 3, maybe 4, 5 years at the outside before it has to start thinking about trying to get re-elected. And politicians often say, I know what to do. My problem is how to get re-elected if I do it. So their time scale is wrong. The second thing is, if they do propose change, there will certainly be losers. But the losers know exactly how much they're going to lose, and they know that loss is going to be immediate. The gainers don't know that they're going to gain, and their potential gains are in the future. So it's a built-in constituency which is against change of any sort. And this is, in fairness to politicians, the environment in which they operate, limited time frames and a built-in conservative, with a very, very small C, outlook on change of any sort, which absolutely militates against bringing in sweeping change.
Sonny, what's your take on it?
I would actually say that politicians actively encourage through legislation and various programs and so forth to increase the reliance on government. Because if you think about it, if somebody is getting something for free,
and a politician argues that I should, that's not right, and we should cut that off, that politician is not going to be elected. He's going to, the one politician that continues the program or increases the benefit, that is the politician that is going to get reelected. So, to Roy's point, they play to the audience. They play to the electorate.
So, here we've seen that banks have been on kind of the short end of the stick, at least the card issuers. Was there a hidden agenda in this whole interchange brouhaha to punish the banks where they couldn't actually get around to punishing them for the role they played in the economic meltdown?
I think there's no doubt. In my judgment, I don't know what Sunny thinks, but to my mind, absolutely no doubt at all. The public wanted a scapegoat. The politicians are only too happy to provide scapegoats. Banks are convenient.
I mean, it seems to me, in the U.S. at least, policy outcome legislation is often a function of campaign contributions in policy outcomes out. I always thought that the banking industry outspent the merchants. So what's missing from that equation? Is it this, you know, displacement of punishment?
Well, if you think about it, there is a public face of the policy, and there are the speeches and getting in front of the microphone, and then there are backroom deals. There's the actual, you know, what do they say? The devil's in the details. You have to pass it before you know what's in it. Well, there you go. So yes, there is public fodder, and banks are they're easy prey. They're easy to beat up on.
Okay. So, boy, this started, was going to be at the beginning a show about trends in reward programs. So now we have a crisis in reward program. What's going to happen? What's the future of rewards near term?
Nasty, short, and brutish, as somebody once said about something else. I think there's no question that interchange has been a significant factor in funding rewards programs, as merchants have complained. And banks have sought, as interchange and other sources of income have declined, banks have sought to find other ways of funding their rewards programs. They tried, for example, what was rather grandly called merchant-funded rewards programs, where effectively the merchant provided a discount which the banks communicated to their customers. And there were difficulties with that, which the merchants were very, very quick to point out. How are you proving that you're generating any new business for me? The banks couldn't do it, and merchant-funded programs, I think, have that built-in weakness. It's hard to see right now quite how banks, as currently constituted with their current financial dynamics, are going to be able to support rewards programs in the future. For me, debit cards never generated enough income to support a rewards program, and I'm not surprised that we see them being turned off. I think in the credit card arena, we're also going to see a reduction in rewards programs. In fact, we're seeing that already in the UK. They're being cancelled or very sharply reduced. And it's hard to see how rewards, as traditionally understood, are going to survive. My own bet is that those banks which are able to work with their merchant acquiring arms to deliver plus value to merchants are going to be able to build some kind of a partnership which between the bank and between the merchant will deliver value to all three parties, let's say the merchant, the bank, and the customer. I think that's a possibility. But it's one which is going to take a lot of rethinking on the part of the two key constituents, let's say the banks and the merchants. But it could be done, I believe.
We've got a couple minutes left till the end of the show. I want to take the mile-high view. Given this willful ignorance, powerless politicians in the globalization context, how is this changing risk factors and the risk profile of the international market? Sunny.
The risk factor is, again, it comes down to, with the globalization, what do merchants like to do. They are trying to lower their overall risk. So by doing so, in order to lower their concentrated risk, they have no choice but to expand globally. But they also are expanding globally into select markets that are favorable to them in with regard to mitigating their risk.
Roy, I'm going to give you the last word because we've got 30 seconds left. How does it change the risk for all of us in the international marketplace, the risk profile?
Let me give you just one figure. The number of middle-class households in India will hit 53 million by 2016. That's 267 million people. That's where I suspect international businesses will be looking, east and south.
Okay. Well, we're at the end of our show. I want to thank you both for being on the show. I think the discussion's been really interesting. And if you in the audience want to suggest a topic or a guest for a future episode, please let me know. Send me an email at trr@globalreach-sbi.com or click on the link on my host page on the voiceamerica.com website. I do want your feedback. Roy, how can anyone get in touch with you if they want to follow up with you?
My email address is roystephor one word at aol.com.
Sunny?
Okay. My email address is it's Sunny, S-O-N-N-Y, dot McKinney at globalcollectusa.com.
And thank you very much for being on the show. And for my guests, Roy Stevenson and Sunny McKinney, and for me, we wish you great success in extending your global reach. And to our listeners in the United States, the show will be rebroadcast next Thursday, and we wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving and a very happy Hanukkah. Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week. Thank you.